This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Bradley Cooper, is nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in Silver Linings Playbook. Cooper grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia, Fresh Air's hometown, and became famous for his role in The Hangover. Since then, he's starred in Limitless and The Words, playing writers in both films. And then there's the title Sexiest Man Alive, which People magazine conferred on him in 2011. Terry spoke with Cooper last Thursday, and they began with a scene from Silver Linings Playbook, which was directed by David O. Russell. Cooper plays Pat Solitano, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder after violently reacting to his wife Nikki having an affair. When the film begins, he's being released from a psychiatric institution with the understanding he'll live in Philadelphia with his parents, who will help him readjust to the outside world. But what he really wants is his wife back, even though she has a restraining order against him. In this scene, it's an Eagles game day. Pat's mother, played by Jackie Weaver, is making snacks. The father, played by Robert De Niro, is on edge, and Pat is preparing to go running. He's hyper and unusually happy, thinking he's about to get a message to his ex.
Making crabby snacks and homemade.
Yeah, come on, Dad, be nice. Come on, she's making crabby snacks and homemade. Come on, Dad!
What are you so up about?
You're very happy.
I'm happy.
No, you're so up.
Isn't that a good thing?
No, you're just up. I don't know what that is. Are you taking the proper dosage of your medication?
Am I taking the right dose? Of course I am.
Okay. Taking a little bit too many or something? Or...
No, if I was taking that, I'd be on the floor, Dad.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your Oscar nomination. So let's start with Silver Linings Playbook and figuring out how to play this character. This character is bipolar, which is pretty serious, but the film's a comedy. So how did you figure out how to play him?
The thing about this movie and this character, Pat Solitano, was just to play him as real and as authentic as we could. And we never discussed the idea of whether it was going to be a comedic tone or a dramatic tone. It was all about being a real tone. So for me, I just focused on that. And then the musicality of the way David directs and the actors that he asked to come together, that sort of dictated the comedy and the drama. And I think it's all based on the characters. For example, if you have two characters that have no filter and are going to have a discussion about the medicines that they take, chances are comedy could be a byproduct. And that sort of occurred when Tiffany Maxwell and Pat Solitano have that discussion around the dining room table about Klonopin and Trazodone and all of the various drugs that they take.
So, you know, you're talking about the music of David O. Russell's writing and directing. And one of the things he does in this film, there's a lot of not only overlapping dialogue, but overlapping like screaming and hysteria. Like with you and De Niro, who plays your father, and then the actress who plays your
Jackie
mother
Weaver,
chiming in. Yeah, she's great. And the neighbor shouting. So I'm wondering how all of that is orchestrated, like what it looks like on the script and what kind of direction David Russell gives you when everybody's kind of hysterical at the same time.
You know, a scene where Robert De Niro and my character, Pat Solitano and Pat Sr., are yelling at each other. For example, in the parlay scene, there's a lot of overlapping screaming. And the dialogue, I think, as written, was just, you know, as Pat comes in, says, "What did you do? You blew it. You know, you spiked the ball at the 1 yard line." But because David really cares about the idea of interaction, once I opened that door, Bob was unleashed onto me, and whatever happened, happened. And what happened was he started to scream at me in such an authentic way, and I immediately started to cry. And like a hyena, I sounded that was sort of shot. And in the editing room, we had to, because we wanted to salvage Bob's performance, because it was so wonderful, we had to constantly take out this sort of crying hyena over my back, which was me crying as Bob was calling me a loser.
What was wrong with your crying? I mean, you said you wanted to be authentic, and you were crying.
It was authentic, but you know, sometimes you realize that things just don't work cinematically. For example, when I read the letter, Nikki's letter, we did one take where David and I found something very sort of real for me, and it unleashed a very emotional reaction, and I cried through the whole letter. And I remember when we were shooting it, and Jennifer sort of, you know, because she's watching it, and she just said, "Bradley, oh my God." And I thought, wow, that was just insane. And then when we got to the editing room, it's just very unpleasant to observe. And you realize, oh, that just doesn't work. That just, you know, less is more. And I think that that also is true for the left, the crying hyena part of that parlay scene. I think it just would have overpowered what Bob was doing. And it just, it sounded so crazy that it just works much better without it.
Do you cry like a hyena in real life?
You know what? I guess I have to say that yes, because I did then, and I wasn't really acting. You know, I mean, it was happening. I think I weep in many different fashions.
You had used the expression "unleashing De Niro," that they unleashed De Niro on me, and De Niro, you know, he's such a mystery to me. I think he's a great actor, obviously.
Have you ever interviewed him?
No, and I probably never will, because my impression is, and you can tell me that I'm wrong, my impression is that he doesn't enjoy being interviewed, and also he never strikes me on those rare occasions when I see him interviewed as somebody who's a particularly verbal person, at least not in an interview situation. He just always seems to be monosyllabic and uncomfortable. Mm. And so when I think of him improvising and suddenly having all this to say and saying it with such animation, and he never seems animated in interviews.
It's interesting. And then you see that man, you know, on a houseboat in a what looks like a sort of a tsunami-like situation, going on a dissertation, almost biblical, in Cape Fear. And you think, wow, that's the same guy? You know, it's incredible. But you're right. In interviews, you think that, well, that is that the same person? But, you know, I've been blessed that he's my friend, and I have witnessed him being extremely articulate. There's no way he could have directed The Good Shepherd and Bronx Tale if he wasn't an articulate person who could, you know, convey his very sort of sophisticated ideas to actors and direct a movie. It's a very hard thing to direct a movie, and certainly a good one. And both of those movies are very good and complicated.
Is there something you could put your finger on that you learned from working with him?
Oh, gosh, so much, Terry, so much. And well, not first of all, just the basics, which he taught me through example more than a sort of didactic approach of sort of sitting me down. Just, you know, don't act. Trust what is happening and don't push it. And I've always sort of thought, as I've been acting the last 12 years, I thought, well, the one thing I do have is this ability to make things seem like they're just that I'm not acting. I've always felt like I can sort of make lines that have been written come out of my mouth in a very realistic way. And then I met Robert De Niro and did the movie Limitless with him, and I realized that wasn't the case. and that happened. I still remember the table read for Limitless, and he comes in on about page 25. And first of all, he's sitting next to me, which was just incredibly intimidating. And I'm the beginning of the movie is basically my character talking. There's a lot of voiceover. And then all of a sudden, he says something to me. And I stopped the reading, and I turned to him. I said, I'm sorry, what's that? And I realized he was actually saying his first line, but it was so grounded, as if he wasn't acting. And I realized, oh, I've just been acting, you know, just, you know, my tail off for the past 20 minutes. And here's an example of somebody, you know, saying what they mean and mean what they say.
What made you want to act?
Well, it crystallized for me at The Elephant Man. I mean, it literally was, you know, I watched the film, the movie ended, and I either turned to my father or myself and thought, I want to be an actor. And that never changed up until today. But before that, I definitely became completely entranced by television and film growing up. I mean, PBS was a huge thing, and watching, you know, Gomer Pyle and Mr. Ed and Colgate Comedy Hour and Sid Caesar and the Show of Shows. I mean, these were all TV shows that I watched all the time in the Jeffersons. And then films, my father would show me movies all the time. When I was very young, from like 10, 11, 12, he would show me Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Hiroshima Mon Amour, Deer Hunter. I mean, movies that just, you know, you wouldn't normally show
a kid.
These
are grim movies for a kid.
These are grim movies, but I think maybe he saw.
How old were you?
I was, you know, very young, before my teens, you know, 10, 11, 12. But I had such a hunger for it. And I think that was prompted by knowing that he was so moved by it. And I always wanted to emulate him. But then that sort of parlayed into me enjoying it on my own.
So when you were watching films with your father, was he a good guide? Would he, like, tell you things to watch out for and talk about the performances or, you know, discuss the implications of the story with you?
No, it was much more like two sort of kids with popcorn in front of them enjoying the film. That was always the great thing about my dad, is I always felt like I was he was my friend. And the only thing I can really remember specifically is we used to have this game that we would have called Would You Put Him in the Movie or Her in the Movie? And we would have this, the ultimate film that would have the best actors. And the way that we would rate performances in movies, would they be worthy of the movie? And so we would be watching a scene, and so I'd turn to him and say, would you put him in? And then we'd say, maybe not. So that was the barometer. But outside of that, there was no sort of intellectual discussion about, you see, son, this is how, you know, you set up the protagonist, or nothing like that.
So who was in the movie?
De Niro was definitely in the movie. Albert Finney was a huge, he had a big role in the movie. He may have been the lead of the movie.
Uh-huh.
But it would change. So I think the character would have many different, it was a long movie, God. And I don't know, the budget would probably have been insane with all the talent. But Peter O'Toole was in the movie. Glenda Jackson, Julie Christie, Omar Sharif, a lot of people. Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder, Shelley Duvall, Jack Nicholson. Yeah, tons of people.
Sounds like an Altman film.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly.
So when you were growing up in Jenkintown, which is a suburb of Philadelphia, you grew up right near a movie theater. How close was it to you?
It was literally in my backyard. The only thing between the movie theater and our back door was a train tracks. There was a thing called the Fairway. It was an old golf course that they then made into a road that they kept the name. And then there was a shopping center. And so I would just go outside through my garage, cross the train tracks, and walk to the movie theater every free chance I had.
So did they show good movies? I mean, was it first-run movies? Or?
Yeah, it was first-run movies. And back then, movies stayed in theaters for 6 months. I remember Platoon was there forever, and Stand By Me was there forever, and Yentl.
But that's bad, because you can't see anything else if it's there forever.
It's bad if you don't like the movie.
So yeah. What did you see there? Like, what was the first movie you saw in a movie theater?
Oh, gosh. I think it was probably Star Wars. But then the movies I remember seeing there, Rocky. But also, I remember seeing Rocky III in Atlantic City, and that was coming out on the boardwalk afterwards and trying to, like, you know, box like Sylvester Stallone. Platoon and Stand By Me are two movies I think I saw probably 30 times in that movie theater, especially Stand By Me. Because, you know, train tracks were right outside my backyard. So I could reenact scenes, you know, right after coming out of the movie theater.
You were on Fresh Air once before, and you spoke with Dave Davies. And you told Dave that for one of your auditions, I think they didn't really want you to audition for the film, but you auditioned anyways, and you sent an audition that you filmed in your kitchen. And I would like to hear more about that audition.
Well, I mean, I did that many times. I was going to grad school, and I was looking up, because I don't know if it's like SAG, there's some sort of thing that you're obligated to put out auditions, like the casting directors are or something. But there would be, you know, calls for, I remember The Patriot for the Heath Ledger role, or Armageddon for the Ben Affleck role when I was in grad school. And so I would be privy to these auditions. So I would put myself on tape. I had like a camcorder, and I would put myself on tape. And I didn't even have anybody to read with. So I would actually read the other character's lines, leave space in the tape recorder, and then say my line. And I did that, honestly, Terry, probably 200, 250 times over the course of 2 years while I was in school. And then I would just hand deliver the tape to whatever casting address there was. And the sort of pitifully sort of heartwarming notion is that I actually, when I thought I did a good job, I thought, oh, there's a chance I could get the role. It was pretty funny. But it was a great learning experience to actually, you know, I remember my audition for Armageddon. it wasn't Armageddon. For the other one, Pearl Harbor, I remember. And you know, and since knowing Ben Affleck now, I sort of told him about it and we were laughing.
Oh, you could carry a film like with that kind of budget, even though nobody knew who you were. Yeah.
Right.
So did you ever get any kind of response to one of the kitchen tapes?
I put myself on tape for a movie called Case 39, when I was in Philadelphia taking care of my father, had something had happened to him, and I got that role. And I remember that was the first time that it worked, and I thought that was just incredible. And then a couple other times, I got to meet Robert De Niro through doing that. I put myself on tape to play his son, and my mother read his lines, and he asked to see me when he was coming through L.A., just because he had seen the tape. And this speaks to his character. Because the whole reason he wanted to meet me was to just say that keep doing what I'm doing. I walked in his room and he said, "You know, you're not going to get this, but I just wanted to tell you that I see it and I see you and yeah."
That's so nice.
And I thought, oh, it was incredible. I mean, for the guy like that to take time out to do that. First of all, to watch some tape and then ask to see the guy. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Your father, who you just mentioned, died in 2011 of cancer. What was going on in your life professionally then? I know you moved back to the Philadelphia area to be with your parents during the last months of his life.
Which was a huge privilege, God. I mean, and that's an example of the good part about being an actor. You know, the bad part is there's no consistency. There's no comfort in knowing you always have a job, but the good part is you can take chunks of time off. We were trying to get a movie to shoot in Philadelphia because I knew he had been diagnosed with lung cancer when we were shooting Hangover 1. I remember we were in Las Vegas doing the press junket, and I got a call when I was in the van from the doctor saying the cancer has come back and it's really bad and he probably has a year. And we had thought he had kicked stage 1 lung cancer, and so this was a shock. And then so from that moment on, which, you know, there was another 2 years before he died, you know, I just tried to make as much as I could time to be with him. So this movie Limitless we shot in Philadelphia. And then after that, I stayed in Philadelphia. And actually, I remember I had a great opportunity to do a movie, and it was sort of a 5-minute decision to not do it. And I just stayed at home and moved back into my parents' house. And it's interesting what an environment can do to the mind. I really did forget that I had a whole life in L.A. I had sort of reverted back to when I was in high school, living in my room, hanging out with, you know, whatever friends from high school still lived in the neighborhood. And, you know, it was just crazy for those 6 months. And then I had to go to Thailand to shoot Hangover 2 for 10 weeks, which was very difficult because I did not want to go. I was terrified that he was going to die while I was away. And then I came back on New Year's Eve and flew right to Philadelphia, and he died January 15th. And I got to take him actually to an Eagles game, the playoffs, the weekend before he died. He hit his head on Tuesday, died on Saturday, and I took him to the game that Sunday.
Did you feel like he was waiting for you to come back?
Yes, absolutely. Unconsciously. The thing about my father was he was such a hard head, and he never thought he was going to die. We never had a discussion about, you know, this is what's going to happen after. It was always, you know what, I think it's, I feel good about it. And, you know, we looked at every possibility to try to kick this thing. There was never any notion that, you know what, it beat me up until the end.
Isn't it remarkable that even when you were in your 30s and a successful actor in a hit film, you go back to the bedroom you grew up in and you feel like you're in high school again, living living with your
parents.
Something. Were you able to deal with that? I mean, because that can be, what's the word I'm looking for? That could be so, stultifying. I mean, it can really cramp your sense of who you are as your own person when you're back in that bedroom and feeling like you're in high school again, even though you're not, even if your parents recognize that you're not, and even though you're there to help them.
It was such a unique situation, though, also, because the dynamic between me and my father had just so oddly changed, you know, where I was, you know, taking washing, you know, how it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he couldn't do anything. You know, I was doing everything that a nurse would do. And, you know, so that was I think that was even more daunting than the fact that I was living in my bedroom that I grew up in. I mean, it was my relationship to him, and that was the thing that was kind of stultifying, to use the word that you used. But it was beautiful, I have to say, Terry. I felt like I became much more in touch with myself during that time period, and certainly the moment he took his last breath was one of the biggest gifts I've ever been given in my whole life. Everything, there was a shift that occurred in that moment. I just stopped caring about so many things that I had given importance to, and the level of perspective that I gained from that experience was massive, and I take it to today.
Well, we're talking about your family. You had one grandfather who was a cop and another who was a fireman.
Correct, yeah.
Did that make you, well, first of all, so many kids want to grow up to be cops or firemen, or at least they used to.
Yeah.
Did you have any aspirations in that direction at any point?
I wanted to be a soldier. That was my thing. I was obsessed with Vietnam when I was a kid. And I
tried to beg my... Oh, that's because you saw Platoon? The Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
Is it because of the deer?
It was all of them. Yeah, it was Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, Platoon. It was a triple threat.
I can't imagine wanting to go to Vietnam or wanting to be a soldier after those films. They're just like such grim portrayals of war and of the Vietnam War. Like, why would you want to do that afterwards?
I don't know what that says about my psychology. But I think I know what it felt like. It was... The men in the movie felt like they understood something about life that others didn't. And I wanted to go through that experience so I would have that knowledge. And I remember articulating that to my father, and that's why I wanted him to allow me to go to Valley Forge Military Academy. And I looked it up on the Yellow Pages and found the number, and I begged him to enroll me into the military academy. And he said, over my dead body will I ever have my son go there. He was in the Army Reserves, and he was... You know, grew up very sort of in a very strict household, but he was a bit of an anarchist himself, a rebel, and he was not elated with the idea of me going into the military. So yeah, that was a bit of a thing between us. But yeah, that's what I wanted to. I loved everything about it, the uniform, the guns, everything. You know, so cop or fireman was not really something. Also because it was very. Something that I knew, you know, I would spend a lot of time with my grandfather and both mainly my mother's father, who was a cop, and also my father's father I knew well. So it wasn't as much of the other, the way a soldier was, you know, that was something that was beyond something that I knew about.
You know what I'm just realizing? You said you wanted to be a soldier. And you, I think, bought the rights to the memoir by Chris Kyle,
the
sniper who was just killed by a fellow veteran, very troubled veteran, who Kyle was trying to help and was taken to a shooting range. And this guy shot and killed him. And you had already bought the rights to his book. It's called American Sniper, The Autobiography of the Most Lethal Sniper in U.S. Military History. He's a former Navy SEAL. That must have been... That must have really shocked you.
I couldn't believe it. Jason Hall, who's writing the script, emailed me an hour after it happened, and then I called him right away. I just couldn't believe it. And I'd spoken to him on the phone, and we were about to dive into it. You know, the first draft was coming in this week. And Thursday, I was at Walter Reed Hospital meeting with veterans who have post-traumatic stress disorder, among many other ailments. And then all of a sudden, I hear this thing, and I just couldn't believe it. You know, the guy has two children, and he is an advocate for putting guns back in veterans' hands. I believe that that's something that he thought was a way of therapy. And I believe the story is that the woman who was his neighbor said, can you take my son out, who is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder? And he and his neighbor took him out, and then the gentleman waited, and then at point-blank range killed him, and then unloaded the rest of his magazine into the other guy and stole his car, his truck. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Are you going to go through with the movie?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I hope to... Where I'm actually going to meet with the writer and the producers at 3 p.m. today to talk about, you know, number one, what we can do for his family, and number two, how we can speed up the process and really try to make this movie. Because his story, first of all, needs to be told, and it's also relevant on two fronts. One, gun control, and two, the need to address this the many soldiers that are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, the thing about it is, you know, medicine has evolved to such a state that, you know, more soldiers are coming back, and they're going to assimilate into the culture. And if we don't address the mental state along with the physical state, you know, it's going to be a problem.
So is your intention to play Chris Kyle or to direct?
Yeah, I would play Chris Kyle, yeah. Another reason why we have to do it soon, because I am 38, so I can't wait too long.
So a question on a lighter note than what we've been talking about. I have to ask you the sexiest man alive question, as I know everybody does.
Oh, I'm so glad.
You're thrilled. But here's my question. You know, there's certain kind of like sexy man poses that I think are just like hysterically funny. And so like there's the sexy man pose where there's a kind of like, this is particularly true of like fashion models, like clothes models. And they're staring at the camera like, I am so attractive. I really can't believe how attractive I am. And they have this like passionate look in their eyes, but you think what's going on there in their mind is, if I could make love to anyone in the world, it would be to myself because I'm that good looking. And then there's that kind of like sexy man pose where like he's running his fingers through his hair thinking, yeah, ladies or some men, you'd like to be doing this too, wouldn't you? And then there's like, you think my T-shirt's a little too tight kind of pose. So like when you're asked to, are you asked to do like, you know, the sexy man poses for photographers?
I mean, as you've described each one, I remember those ones being taken. literally, I remember them exactly. I remember I was doing this shoot years ago and we were outside and I could not see because the sun was right in my eyes, and the look was that look, that's the first one you described.
The I am so handsome.
Yes, but all I was doing was desperately trying to keep my eyes open, and it was like, it was very arduous. And then the hands through the hair is, I definitely have done that a lot, but that was because I absolutely hate having my photograph taken. I mean, it is like torture, and I just... And so they can sense that, the photographers. So they ask me to do stuff. And I've only learned recently that I can actually say no and just, you know, sorry, but you're just going to have to take it the way it is. You know, starting out, I would do anything they said, you know, jump up and down and do whatever they, you know, grab a mandolin, whatever you're going to do. And so I definitely, for some reason, the hair and the hands and the hair, I think they liked because I was doing something and it sort of took me out of my head maybe. But yeah, I am – that kind of stuff makes me feel sick to my stomach.
What have you said no to?
Oh, gosh. I won't jump on a trampoline anymore. I think that I've sort of ruled out.
What's the point of the trampoline?
I think they like, you know, motion, you know, movement.
Right.
Anything movement. Right. You know, the old, you know, would you mind, you know, the looking off but then putting your eyes back to camera, that thing? No, that's no bueno. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like your face is away but then your eyes come back.
Right.
You know, almost that look.
And what's that supposed to signify?
I don't know. Like, I don't know. But it looks just so awful. And then there's the other one of like, you know, sort of... you know, holding onto your body or something, or like putting your hand, you're resting your hand on your hands or something, that whole thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They often do that, you know. Would you mind just doing that? Especially when you go to promoting a movie in a foreign country. They hate me because they'll often take stills after the interview and then they'll say, could you please put your hand? I said, no, I'm sorry. No, you can't do this. No, sorry. And also, if you ever smile, ever, that's the one they're going to use. And I remember my friend and I agreed to do this magazine, and I was very excited because my friend is a great photographer. I said, you have to do it with him. And so they said, okay. And we said, okay, no smiling. And one click he did of me smiling after a whole day, and that was the cover.
Well, let me wish you good luck. Good luck to you. And
thank you.
This has been so much fun. I really appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Oh, well, it's a real honor for me, Terry, I have to tell you. A real honor to be here, and thank you.
Bradley Cooper speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Cooper's performance in Silver Linings Playbook is nominated for an Oscar. Coming up, director Michael Apted talks about the Up series, popular documentary films that have aired in the UK since 1964. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. You know the sensation of looking back at photos or videos of yourself over the years and seeing how you've changed? Imagine getting that kind of feeling by watching movies made over the years about people you don't know. The documentaries known as the Up series have that effect on many people. The series began in 1964 when Granada TV in England broadcast the documentary film Seven Up about the lives of 14 children who were 7 years old and from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds. Every 7 years since then, filmmakers have returned to the people from the original film to document how their lives have changed. The new edition, number 8 in the series, is called 56 Up, and catches up with its subjects at the age of 56. Our next guest, Michael Apted, was a researcher on 7 Up and has directed all the subsequent Up films. Apted is British and lives in America. He's also directed many movies, including Coal Miner's Daughter, Gorky Park, Gorillas in the Mist, and the James Bond film The World Is Not Enough. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Michael Apted, welcome and thank you for joining us. Let me go back to the very beginning. When 7 Up was first made, you were the researcher for the series. You weren't yet the director, which you became. So one of the things you had to do was choose the children. How did you go about choosing them?
Well, it was pretty arbitrary and very quick. It was part of a weekly series of programs, World in Action. I would ring the schools up. The schools, I'd say, would you help us make this film? And they would say yes or no. Then I'd go to the school and say to the teachers, teaching the seven-year-olds, bring me your brightest and your best. And I would look at them, talk to them, and then pick a couple. And the next thing that happened was, you know, there they were in front of the camera. So it was done in a very arbitrary way because we weren't interested in the personalities so much. We needed children who could, weren't fazed by us, who could speak to us, but we weren't looking for any particular characteristics. We were just interested in their backgrounds. The idea of the film was to examine the British class system in 1963-64 to see whether it was changing, seeing it was reflecting the great cultural upheavals that were going up in the United Kingdom from the Beatles onwards. So instead of getting professionals in to talk about it, the idea was that we would get some seven-year-old children from different backgrounds, from rich backgrounds, from poor backgrounds, from rural backgrounds, from people who were removed from their parents, to get within about 14 children and have them talk about their lives, their ambitions, their dreams and whatever, and see whether that told us anything. And of course, it did, because it was both very funny and also chilling, showing that, in fact, the class system was very active and that people in certain backgrounds had a real vision of their future and others really didn't know what day it was. And so, you know, it made that point and the rest is history.
So this was supposed to be just a one shot. And then you stepped in and you wanted to do another one and eventually make it a series. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I wish what you said was true, because then I could claim credit for it. But no, the film went out. It was a huge success. It was funny and chilling. And it took us 5 years before someone actually piped up and said, well, why don't we go back and see what happened to them? And we all thought, oh, that might be good. So we did go back. It wasn't a very interesting film because they were monosyllabic, spotty, and just general teenagers. But, you know, you could see the beginnings of a great idea that I don't think anybody had ever seen before. And so from then on, we all got behind it and we decided let's keep going back as long as we could and let this thing grow and see what happens to it.
So what was it like for you? What's it been like for you every 7 years to drop in on these people's lives and, you know, ask them about the landmark events that have happened in the seven-year interim?
What can I say? I mean, it's the favorite thing I've ever done, the thing I'm most proud of. It's nerve-wracking because you always think you're going to blow it and you'll wreck the whole thing. It seems fragile. And I've learned a lot of lessons about it. I've made mistakes on it and had to correct those mistakes. You know, particularly I got into a situation, I think, early on when I became judgmental about people, that if they didn't agree with my standards of success, failure, happiness, whatever, then, you know, that I would feel they were the lesser for it. And also I tried to play God. I tried to predict what might happen to people and sort of set it all up for that. And I did that, and that was an embarrassing mistake. And I think what I've learned all the way through is the less I do, the better, that the more I let them speak for themselves. Because what's so interesting about the films to me is that they're all different. They all have a different tone to them. The 56 took me completely by surprise. And my feeling is if I'd gone in just to update 49 when I did 56 and ask the same questions and see what the response would be, then I wouldn't have got such an interesting film out. I in a way, try and become like a blank slate and start all over again and have a conversation with them about their lives and what's going on, and try not to lead them anywhere I think they should be led and let them do the leading.
What did surprise you about 56 Up?
Well, that people seemed happy. I mean, I thought they'd be getting depressed, worried about age, very worried about the economic climate, looking back on their lives, maybe sometimes with regret. But no, I mean, what was so interesting to me was that, you know, that a lot of them had found real kind of comfort in their families and their extended families. I was of the belief in my life that you can't have everything, you know, that I had pursued a career, I was ambitious, and I paid a price for it. I wasn't as good a father or a husband as I should have been. And sometimes I thought, well, maybe that's my way and maybe that's the right way. But then I saw the payoff that people who'd put their energies into their families and their loyalties into their families, that at this age, in their mid-50s, you know, they'd got real pleasure and power from it.
Can I say something that will contradict what you just said? And this is just
Please.
Coming from my perspective as a film viewer. I didn't make the movie, so, you know, I'm just a casual film goer, but it seems to me there's a lot of pain in 56 Up. You've got woman who has rheumatoid arthritis, and she can't sit long, she can't stand long, she can't walk long, she has pain in her fingers, she can't type, and she's unemployed, and she says, who's going to employ me? I can't even guarantee I'm going to show up to work. You have somebody in the movie who has had a nervous breakdown years ago, who suffers with what appears to be chronic depression, and among the things, he has some very fulfilling things in his life now, but one of the things he seems very bitter about is that even with all the attention that this series of movies has brought him, no one will give his writing a second look. No one's even going to take it seriously enough to pass judgment on it. You've got somebody else who has like 5 kids, I think, from his first marriage, 3 of whom aren't talking to him. You know, and I could go on, but it seems to me there's a lot of pain in this film.
Yes, you're right. Everybody has their failures, everybody has their regrets. But let's go through these people. Let's take Jackie, who's lost the father of her children, she's lost her mother-in-law, she's lost her sister. But have you ever seen anybody as bright and courageous as that? Someone who keeps saying lines like, you know, my glass is half full, not half empty.
I'm going to stop you right there. But I hear that and I sometimes wonder, are they saying that because they want to say it and not be necessary? I mean, I did really wonder, like, does she really feel that way? Is she really more sad and depressed about her life right now, but is wanting to put on a good face for the camera or just for the world in general?
Well, that's not my feeling about it. I mean, you may be right. Mm-hmm. We all have our own perspectives on the things that you've numbered out here for me. And I think you relate it to your life, I relate it to my life, but I think what's unique, rare about these films is that you do in some ways know these people quite well, although you don't know them at all. And I think you can relate to them and make your own judgments on them and, you know, get something for yourself from it. Now, if you get a negative thing from this, so be it. I didn't, and I was surprised. I was happy that I didn't, because we've had glum ones. 35 Up was pretty glum because they seem to be losing a lot of parents, and so it was much more about death and loss than any of the other ones have been. And I thought we may be getting a rerun of that at 56, but to my way of thinking, I came away, and it's only me, with a sense of positivism about it.
I'm interested in hearing some of the ground rules that, so to speak, that you've set for the Up series. I know, for instance, like you've paid the interviewees in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Was it that way from the start, or is that something that you instituted in subsequent films?
Yeah, I started paying them at 28, you know, when we became, as it were, more international. Once it came to America, the film, and 28 was the first one to be shown in America, you know, then there was sort of some money around in terms of, you know, royalties and things like that. And so we would give them their share of it. But I also thought they should have a fee for being it. It was very, very small, but it's increased over the years. Not that the films make money, but, you know, I feel they should be paid for it. And so I juggle the budget around, you know, so I can pay them a bit more each time, because I think what they do is courageous and not many people would do it. So why shouldn't they get some material advantages out of it?
And when you ask a question, and you know that that question is making the person you're interviewing uncomfortable and maybe pushing them to speak a little more privately than they'd care, how do you balance your desire to be protective of them because they've become people who you care very much about with your desire to get the best film possible, which probably means pushing them a little bit past their comfort zones?
Yeah, what you have to understand is there's a set of rules when you do longitudinal films. You know, you have to behave yourself as the director, as the interviewer, because you want them to come back. I mean, if they say they don't want to talk about something and I ask them the question and I embarrass them or unsettle them and then I insist on using it, then they'll never come back. So I do have these moments. I have moments when, you know, I know there's a question I've got to ask them. I know there's a question that if I don't ask it, the audience will say, why didn't he ask that? And I know that question might be hurtful. Now, to some of them, I wouldn't ask it because it would break them down. Others, I think, are more resilient, and I ask it. And sometimes they get upset about it, and then we have the discussion about, do I use it or do I not use it? And that, you know, that happened in 56 Up sort of fairly graphically. And we had this discussion and, you know, we used it in the film. So it's that sort of process. But it differs from what you do in a way, because you have me here once and you can use whatever you want because you probably won't want me back again. But with these people, I want them back.
Never.
No, I'm not being childish, but I want them back. And so, you know, I do have to behave myself.
So can you give us an example of something that you actually, you know, talked about whether to use or not use that was...
Yeah, I mean, it was with Tony, the jockey. You know, we've had long discussions over the last three or four films about the changing racial profile of the East End of London, which he left, and he left because, you know, he regarded as being invaded by Bangladeshis, you know, by people from, you know, particularly Asian communities, and the East End of London has changed dramatically. You know, and he has had things to say about that, and sometimes I wondered whether he was pushing it too far, what he was saying, and so in 56... I just came out with it and said, you know, you sound to me, Tony, as though you're being racist. And he answered that, and he was very indignant about it and upset about it. I thought he answered it very well. And so I put it in the program, and then, you know, he asked, had I put it in? I said, yes. And he said, how is it? I said, well, I think you should look at it. So he looked at it, and he said, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, I think you answered it well. That's my opinion. And so he, you know, he took some advice from family and whatever and decided to keep it in. But that was an example of the process that can go on between us because we all have a commitment to, as it were, staying on the same page.
So do you have to grapple with feelings of responsibility for the people whose lives you're documenting during those periods of their lives when they're in trouble?
Well, I would, yes, and I have done. Yes, I mean, you know, I've given up any notion of objectivity. I mean, you know, I care about them all, and if they need help and I can help, or they need advice and I can give it, then certainly I do. Yes, I don't shut myself off and say, look, I'm a documentarian here and I have to be objective, so please be quiet and I'll see you in 7 years. It can't exist like that.
Are you saying there were times you actually, like, helped people out?
Yeah. Sure.
What kinds of things, if you don't mind my asking, and if you do, that's fine.
No, I don't mind. I mean, I've lent money to one or two of them if they've needed it, and they've always paid it back. But, you know, if they're in trouble with stuff, I've always been prepared to help. And, you know, on a brighter side, a cheerful side, I mean, if people come out to California, they come and stay with me. Bruce was here this summer with his wife and two kids, and Nick's been out with his son and stayed with me. I mean, I love all that. And if I have a movie opening in London... I always, you know, hire a theatre and invite them all and their neighbours and friends to show it. It's great for me to be able to do something for them without, you know, without me asking for stuff in return. I mean, I'm always the supplicant asking them to do things, and it's nice when I can do things for them when I'm not asking for anything, just to give them something and to have a good time. So, you know, that's the bright side of it all as well. We have a positive relationship, and we all sort of, you know, have our moments together. I'm closer to some than others, but we are a sort of a family, and we are bonded by this, even if there are others that, you know, I don't see much of. I think we all feel that we're in this together, and I think we all have a respect for what we're doing. I think we all think it's worth doing.
You started 7 Up long before reality television. And now, mm-hmm. in the era of reality television, many of the people in those shows are there because they have outsized personalities. They're willing to do things that are ridiculous or shameless even, and are willing to be ridiculed, because that's how a lot of people watch reality TV, to ridicule the people who are in it. Do you find ever that people are watching your Up series in the spirit of reality TV, which is not the spirit that the movies are intended to be in?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, it was a big issue for us, especially when we did 49 Up, because that was the elephant in the room. You know, reality television had really got a grip of in British television at that time, and so my participants were saying, are we another cheesy reality show? And if so, why aren't we being paying tons of money like American Idol? And I had to try to explain what I perceived as the difference between a reality and the documentary. With reality, they take people out of their comfort zone, out of their homes, as it were, and put them into other situations. And sometimes that's very interesting and rewarding. Sometimes it's cruel and unusual. And what we try and do is, in a sense, every 7 years, get as truthful as we can snapshot of what these people's lives are. And we are not driven, you know, by having to have high drama. As you said earlier, this is the drama of real life. This is like a novel, like a Victorian novel, when characters move half an inch every 7 years. But since it's all so familiar to us, we're tracking that. And that, in the end, that's much more dramatic than watching, you know, Cops and Robbers or whatever, James Bond or whatever, because it's something you really relate to. So, you know, I don't feel I have to beef it up like reality. I don't feel I have to compete with the reality, because in another way, I think this series of films exists on a different plane from reality, and not an unpopular plane. I mean, we do very well in terms of crass, you know, numbers and business and all this kind of stuff.
Michael Apted, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on yet another in the series of Up movies.
Well, thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Director Michael Apted speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Apted's latest documentary in the Up series is called 56 Up. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuti.